Welcome to the Mackenzie Call Series. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Dan Cremon-Prey, Vice President, Head of Inside Sales. Please go ahead, Mr. Cremon-Prey.
Thank you very much for that, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for dialing in. We do know that you have many options out there right now, and at Mackenzie Investments, our goal remains and has always been to be a valued partner and resource for you always by providing timely updates from our portfolio managers and our leaders. On today's call, we have Todd Mattina joining us. He's a Senior Vice President and Co-Lead of the Mackenzie Multi-Asset Strategies Team and Chief Economist for Mackenzie Investments. We also have our second speaker, Darren McKiernan. Darren is our Senior Vice President of Investment Management and is Head of the Mackenzie Global Equity and Income Team. We're going to start by hearing from Todd. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. And Todd, we know there's no shortage of information out there. So with all of it, where do we begin?
Well, thanks so much, and thanks to everybody for calling in. It's great to have this opportunity to speak with everyone, especially about turbulence in markets. So maybe I can just start by talking about sort of the market impact of the coronavirus sell-off, and then I'll touch on sort of the macro policy outlook and the overall economic outlook, and I'll try to wrap up with some investment implications. So starting with the market impact of the coronavirus-related sell-off, it initially started in a fairly orderly way, but in the last couple of weeks, we're starting to see more signs of stress in different key markets. Just looking at yesterday's market action, the U.S. equity market sold off, touching 30% at one point before rebounding today, which really represented one of the most rapid ends to a bull market in U.S. stock market history. Yesterday's sell-off, as you probably know, in U.S. stocks was 12%. It was the second largest fall behind the 1987 crash. And the VIX, which the market's so-called fear gauge, reached a record high of just over 82 on Monday, which was higher than even in the global financial crisis. Credit spreads have also blown out, effectively locking out many corporate borrowers. And we've seen central bank policy rates dropping to about zero in the big three economies, U.S., Eurozone, and Japan. So we've seen obviously a very dramatic set of events related to the sell-off. This virus outbreak continues to spread globally. We have total cases now of over 185,000, and the epicenter has shifted from being centered in China and the Asia-Pacific region to Europe and increasingly here in North America. The strategy at this stage of the game is really about governments trying to flatten the curve. And by that, what I mean is trying to avoid the short-term spikes in the caseload related to the coronavirus that could really crush the healthcare system under the intense pressure of so many short-term caseloads. In the U.S., the Center for Disease Control projections said in a worst case, we could see millions of potential hospitalizations in the United States unless effective containment measures were put in place, which we're starting to see done now. Now, while containing it and trying to extend over a longer period of time, this virus outbreak makes a lot of sense. It'll save lives and take pressure off the healthcare system. It also comes at a pretty severe short-run economic cost. Quarantines, business shutdowns, border closures, they do successfully contain and slow the spread, but they can result in disruptions in production, income, and global supply chains. And some of the data we've seen come out this week from China, which has already moved past the peak of its crisis in January, February, really confirmed that. China's GDP growth is probably tracking at a rate in the first quarter of this year of minus 10% based on some of the data we've seen, and I'll expand on that in a moment, but really quite a severe contraction. Monetary and fiscal policy tools, our standard sort of toolbox for dealing with economic crises, they can help certainly on the demand side of the equation, putting a floor under demand, but lower interest rates, government cash transfers can't really get people to spend more at restaurants when we're all working from home under quarantine. So these macro policies, though, are still, I would argue, extremely critical at this time, mainly to try to put a backstop on credit and household liquidity risks. Obviously, over the next quarter, possibly as long as the next 2 quarters, as we're dealing with the coronavirus outbreak, we're going to see businesses dealing with a cash squeeze, both from lower revenues while still facing their debt payments. And same with households. Many, especially those who are the most vulnerable, those who are wage earners who are going to face a cash squeeze if they're no longer able to go out and work. So macro policies, particularly fiscal policies, will be increasingly important in the days and weeks ahead to put a backstop, to backstop that kind of credit and liquidity risk for both households and the business sector. And I'll expand on those policies in a minute. But ultimately, we're going to need a medical solution to solve what is a medical problem. As this outbreak is contained, we would expect a bounce in financial markets and in the economy later in the year. Now, what that bounce looks like, well, initially the focus was on a V-shaped bounce. Increasingly, though, as we try to flatten the curve of caseloads and push out more cases out into the future rather than letting it burn through the population very quickly, which would have a devastating human cost to that, but by extending the caseload further out, we're going to be dealing with these effects for at least the next 2 quarters. So seeing a bounce looks more U-shaped increasingly than the rapid V-shape that many economists and strategists have been originally anticipating. Now, as this slowdown, this coronavirus-linked slowdown does move through the economy, and coupled with a very inopportune oil price war led by the Saudis with the failure of the OPEC Plus arrangement, we're starting to see a variety of stresses. And those stresses come in a number of forms. Credit spreads have blown out, risking a freeze in credit markets for businesses that need to refinance short-term funding, particularly in the commercial paper market. Money markets and repo markets in the U.S. Were at risk of seizing up as holders of liquid cash were holding on to that cash. They weren't as happy to part with it in exchange for even high-quality treasuries, which led the Fed and other central banks to come in with trillions of dollars of liquidity commitments to try to keep those funding markets open. And then, of course, we've seen the enormous pickup in volatility in equity markets that stripped circuit breakers and curving trading multiple times in the last 2 weeks. We're going to need to see a sustained normalization of that volatility in equity markets before we form a meaningful bottom to this. And then finally, the other disruption that I see sort of in the markets right now is in the inflation market. If you look at U.S. inflation-linked bonds, the TIPS market, break-even inflation, which is really the market's proxy for expected inflation over the next 10 years, has reached low levels that we haven't seen since 2009, which just really highlights the speed and depth that Treasury yields have dropped so quickly in the last 2 weeks. So that's a very quick summary of where we are on things. What I would suggest we do is focus a little bit on the next part, which is really the growth outlook. And there I would say we are at increased risk of at least a technical recession at the very least, particularly in multiple regions. Regions that had especially initially weak starting conditions, Japan, Italy, France, these economies actually had economic contractions in the fourth quarter of 2019. So they already were starting from a relatively weaker position. And now with the coronavirus sell-off and economic downturn, it's not unreasonable to expect at least technical recessions of back-to-back negative growth. The risk to global growth is also increasing. Four former chief economists of the IMF have all come out predicting a global recession in 2020. So recession risks have certainly increased. Here in North America, the key will be both the progression of the outbreak, which is, of course, almost impossible to predict over the next 2 quarters, but will certainly appears to be severe, but also the aggressiveness of the fiscal policy response to try to put a floor under demand conditions and backstop credit conditions. I think those two things are going to be very critical in terms of managing the economic response over the next couple of quarters. And speaking on policies, let me just spend a moment on running through what we've seen on the policy front so far. So far, we've seen an incredible response by the Fed. It's pulled out its so-called bazooka over the weekend, dropping its policy rate, the Fed funds rate, to basically zero. It's provided or committed to provide up to trillions of dollars of liquidity to money markets and the repo market to make sure that's a smooth functioning market. That's absolutely critical for bank funding and for funding leveraged positions by many investors. Keeping that well functioning is critical to prevent a more violent type of unwind in financial markets. So the Fed has really stepped up to do that. They've restarted quantitative easing, as you may have heard, with $700 billion in additional bond purchases. So that will translate into about $40 billion in monthly asset purchases this month alone. They've reduced bank reserve requirements to zero and allowed banks to borrow from their discount window for up to 3 months, as well as providing swap lines to foreign central banks so that they have access to U.S. dollar liquidity. And very importantly, this happened today, they opened up the commercial paper funding facility, a crisis-era facility that will allow the Fed to basically on-lend directly to commercial paper markets to provide funding to companies that would face basically being locked out of funding markets without this kind of facility, particularly at current blown-out spreads.
So, Todd, on that...
Yeah, please.
Has the Fed exhausted all of their ammunition with this, or do they have other levers that they could move to, or would it be more of what they're already doing if they needed to do more to stimulate the economy and the markets?
So I think, I mean, the Fed has used a lot of its ammunition, and I think global central banks are getting to a place where the monetary ammunition is getting largely exhausted. They had a few tools left after the Sunday bazooka announcement, including the commercial paper funding facility, which they implemented today with the U.S. Treasury. There's a couple of additional facilities, sort of crisis-era facilities that they could still introduce to try to support and backstop credit and liquidity conditions, including a primary dealer credit facility, and importantly, something called the term auction facility. That was something... that they used instead of using the stigma, they have the highly stigmatized discount window is when banks that are troubled, that are having funding issues can go to the Fed to seek emergency funding through the discount window. But that is often a trigger for runs and other kind of panics. So the Fed has set up this term auction facility, which is kind of a substitute for that with much less stigma. They still haven't launch that facility yet. So I suppose if conditions get worse, they could still pull that out. But I think the bottom line for me, and I should say that other central banks, now that the ECB has launched QE, the Bank of Japan has doubled the size of its annual budget for direct asset purchases, I think into the neighborhood of $100 billion or so. So, you know, we are seeing more quantitative easing type measures, given that policy rates have been dropped to zero, or even negative for some countries. But it's fiscal policy now where, you know, that will be the lever that policymakers will need to pull.
Thank you for that.
On fiscal policy, I mean, today it's been a big day on fiscal policy. The U.S., there's news that the U.S. Treasury, Steve Mnuchin and President Trump are requesting an $850 billion or even larger fiscal stimulus package in the U.S., which would include sending $1,000 checks to American households within the next 2 weeks, according to news reports. This would be a huge stimulus measure. It would go some ways to supporting demand, and I'm sure that would be helpful from an economic point of view, although I think stepping back, we have to realize that this is unlike other types of business cycle shocks, obviously. When people are quarantined in their homes, lower interest rates and receiving direct cash transfers can support confidence, can maybe underpin demand, put a floor under demand, but it doesn't get people back out of their houses, buying cars, going to restaurants to spend. Obviously, with social distancing, that's not feasible. So there are limits to how far our standard macro policy tools can go. it'll be really important, I think, for them to avoid allowing the policies we absolutely need to contain the virus from morphing into a broader credit and liquidity crisis. So I think they're doing the right thing by introducing these kinds of backstops, both by central banks and you know, fiscal authorities distributing checks to households to boost demand. But I think we have to accept that, you know, during the next quarter or two, we will see definitely weaker economic performance.
And Todd, talk to us about Canadian fiscal policy.
Certainly. So the government's already announced about $1 billion, $1.1 billion, in fiscal measures in Canada. Those are earmarked to allow for faster employment insurance, funding medical supplies, and part of the backstopping of credit, the Business Development Bank and Export Development Corporation would have more resources to provide credit. Prime Minister Trudeau came out today saying that on Monday, I believe, that they would announce an additional package. I think that would go some ways further. One of the economic shops have said that such a Canadian fiscal stimulus should be at least $20 billion. So we could see a sizable package coming out in the next several days or a week.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And, you know, other major economies, Germany and France, for example, have announced very large fiscal programs to do this kind of work. Germany announced, for example, a 500 billion euro backstop through its development bank to guarantee business loans. France announced a 300 billion euro blanket guarantee for bank loans to businesses to ensure that there's no sort of surge in defaults due to a cash and liquidity squeeze during the next month or so when these containment measures for the virus are sort of taking their maximum effect.
Do you want to touch a little bit on investment implications for us? We talked about the importance of investment horizon and rebalancing. What is your thoughts there?
Yeah, no, happy to do that. And I think there's some important ones. The first is, I think I'm often asked, what are the investment implications for different types of investors? And I really think it's important to differentiate your investment horizon. So for long-term investors, valuations are getting cheaper. This really implies, I mean, if you can stomach the high short-term volatility that we've been experiencing, the best advice is to hold on. We know that when valuations drop sharply and long-run intrinsic valuations are largely unaffected, you're going to have a higher long-run average return over that long horizon. But it could be a very volatile and tricky path. For people, and when I say long horizon, I'm thinking of people who are saving for pensions, saving for college, people who have a 10-year horizon or more, RESP, RRSP type investors who might have a 10-year plus type horizon. But for other types of investors, for traders, for people with shorter horizons, we're going to see a very bumpy ride, I think, in financial markets. I mean, the VIX is at 82 yesterday. It was in the 70s today. So we're going to see a period of elevated volatility. My advice would be, it's very difficult to try to tactically time the markets in these kinds of very uncertain times with a very uncertain type of shock, the coronavirus, and how it progresses over the next couple of months. So I wouldn't actively try to time markets based on where we think the coronavirus is going to go or how it'll evolve. But I would recommend that don't try to catch the falling knife. I mean, in terms, at some point, I would expect there to be a good opportunity to re-enter equities. But that will probably, I would be waiting for a number of indicators. Those would include things like a sustained drop in forecasts of volatility by markets, things like the VIX index, looking for market technicals that start to support these improved valuations that we're seeing so that we get more alignment between a better macroeconomic outlook when this thing is finally contained, the more attractive valuations after the sell-off, and then more attractive sort of technical sentiment type factors. When these things start aligning, then I think you get a really bullish a more bullish environment than certainly where we are today. There's other factors I think that, or I guess investment implications I would highlight quickly as well. One is the importance of rebalancing for a multi-asset portfolio. You know, during 2008, investors who regularly rebalanced to their target or long-run asset mix could experience a lower maximum drawdown during that period and a quicker rebound in their portfolio. I think it's important to continue regular rebalancing through this period. You know, there could be many investors out there who, after the long bull run in 2019, are, you know, overweight equities relative to their long-term asset mix. It might be a good time to get back to neutral. If you're underweight now equities because you were closer to your long-term asset mix before the coronavirus-related sell-off, say in early February, you might be underweight equities now. Same rationale would apply. I think it's good to sort of rebalance periodically to your target mix. And it's also a sensible way, you know, yields, fixed income duration risk is also increasing. Yields have dropped sharply in the huge, you know, rush for safe haven assets like U.S. Treasuries, high-quality government bonds, and so on. With really low yields, duration risk could possibly be a new risk factor or a greater risk factor in your multi-asset portfolio compared to normal. So rebalancing is a good way to sort of make sure that your risk factors are, you know, more in line with where you want them to be in terms of your strategic asset mix. And the last investment advice I would really highlight is liquidity is paramount. Liquidity and credit risk. You know, look at your portfolios, look for, you know, types of investments that might have underlying e-liquidity, you know, funds that may have, you know, daily liquidity but hold a high amount of very illiquid assets. To some fund managers have had difficulty with that, like GAM in Europe and others. It's important to sort of be watching for those kinds of liquidity mismatches. And just in general, trading a lot in this market, it can be costly because bid-ask spreads have widened out quite a bit. So, it's important, especially for the smaller cap names, to keep an eye on those things.
Todd, thanks a lot for that. I'm going to come back to you with a question and answer period so we get to stick around, but I'd love to turn things over to Darren. Now, Darren, the current situation must be providing some pretty good opportunities for you and the team. And I know that you can't go into any specific details, but tell us a bit about your portfolios right now.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dan. And again, I want to first of all extend my best wishes to everyone that's on the call. And obviously, we're all very focused on the health of our families and our friends and even our neighbors here. But I want everyone to know that we continue to execute in our role as a fiduciary, even from the from the confines of my home at this point. During this time of really pretty unprecedented uncertainty, we continue to work diligently to quantify the impact that this pandemic is having on our companies. Now, this means we're, you know, trying to assess as best we can the near-term impact of the virus, but even more importantly, to confirm that our long-term investment cases are still intact. Now, don't get me wrong, and as Todd pointed out quite succinctly, we expect some pretty negative earnings comparisons over the next several quarters for most, if not all, of our companies. Now, this has obviously been pressuring stock prices and valuations. However, by and large, this decline in profitability is being offset by what is still healthy cash flows and strong balance sheets in the businesses that we own. So in many cases, we have actually seen stock prices in both the companies we own and prospective Dream Team companies fall well below what we believe to be their underlying medium to long-term intrinsic values. Now, this is why our discipline hasn't changed. And as you guys know, people that have heard me speak, it involves constantly assessing our current holdings with potential upgrades via our Dream Team. Now, we're doing our best to that end to take advantage of this uncertainty and this really extreme volatility. And in some cases, we've had to act pretty quickly, much more quick than we usually do. In short, we're upgrading the portfolio by either buying superior names with similar discounts or buying names of similar quality with much deeper discounts. So what have we done? Well, this is pretty much, I'd say, since the middle of February. As of right now, almost 23% of the fund has been turned over or is in the process of being turned over. We have sold or selling down 25 names, and we have bought or are buying 16 for a net reduction of 9 companies. So in short, we have been consolidating our holdings and upgrading the portfolio. And a portfolio which, by the way, which was quite high quality before this all began. And I'd also point out that we remain more or less fully invested. Okay, we are not trying to try. We understand that things are volatile. They're going to be, as Todd would mention, and I believe as well, going to get even more volatile. We're going to have days like these last 4 days, up huge on Thursday, down huge on Friday, down huge yesterday. Up fairly decent today. I think I read something saying that yesterday something like 10% of the S&P 500 names in the S&P 500 were down at least over 20%. So it's quite rare what we're seeing right now. And it's also important to note that I'll point out that, you know, there's stuff that we're buying today that in 2 weeks' time we might be selling to buy better stuff. So this is a very fluid situation, but our process has not changed, and it's why we've been able to act actually fairly quickly. As everyone knows, 23% turnover in 2 weeks is about as much as I typically do in 18 months, a year and a half. We wouldn't be in a position to do this unless we had were prepared and we knew the companies that we were buying. The point is, you know, the companies we own or are buying suddenly didn't become worth 30% less than they were a month ago. And we are confident that once COVID-19 runs its course, that these companies will resume growing. Now, but whether it's in 3 months or 6 months or 9 months time is hard to predict, obviously. Todd made some comments on that as well. But we do know this won't last forever. We also know that stock markets are leading indicators. And while I can't and I won't call a bottom, my guess is we will hit a point of maximum pessimism sometime before then. And again, if we're not already there, it certainly feels pessimistic out there. That's for sure. But again, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months isn't forever. It might feel like it. It seems like it. But if you've got a time horizon, Todd mentioned 10 years, I would say 3 or 5 years. I think this is not the time to be panicking. I would also point out that based on my understanding of the businesses we own and are buying and the underlying discounts, I would openly say that the prospective 5-year returns for the fund have never been more attractive than at any point since I joined McKinsey over 6 years ago. And finally, before I hand it over back to Dan and to some of your questions, hopefully, I'd like to point out that if I'm not the largest, I am among the largest single individual unit holders of the fund. This is effectively my PA. I am treating this like it is my money because it is my money. And needless to say, I haven't sold a share and I have been adding during this downturn. So with that, hopefully we have some questions and love to hear any thoughts people have on their mind.
Darren, I know that last piece is very powerful for people to hear. Question has come up without knowing the ins and outs of our competition. Why has your team performed so well, relatively speaking, against both the benchmark and our large competitors since late Feb? I'm putting you on the spot here. I know.
Yeah, no, you know, I first of all, that's right now. It doesn't, you know, being ahead a little bit in a market that's down so much doesn't feel great. And I, you know, at this point in time, quartile rankings kind of go out the window, in my opinion. All I can say is that, you know, our focus on owning high quality dividend paying companies with solid balance sheets and, relatively predictable businesses. Of course, the next 2 or 3 quarters are going to be anything but that. Just sticking to our knitting, I think, is the key. And I would say, you know, this is what, you know, it feels awful. And when it feels this awful to be buying things, it's usually the right thing. But all I can say is right now I feel like the portfolio is in better shape today than it was 3 weeks ago. It certainly is a lot lower than it was 3 weeks ago, but I feel that the discounts of the businesses we own and the quality of the businesses we own has gone up since that time. And again, I can only look forward over the next, you know, again, this virus is going to work its course. Timing is uncertain, but it's not going to last forever. And when it does, when the clouds part and the sun comes up, I think we're going to be in pretty good position.
Well, the conviction right now is imperative for all of our portfolio managers in this entire industry. We'd like to open it up and take some questions from our listeners. Justina, over to you.
Thank you. We'll now take questions from the telephone line. If you have a question and using a speakerphone, please hit your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Please press *1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register. Thank you for your patience.
Todd, while we're waiting for our first question, can you talk a little bit about China's market and how it's responded post-peak of confirmed COVID-19 cases? And can we expect a similar response in North America?
Yeah, no, happy to do that. It was interesting. Monday, we had a number of China's economic indicators were published, and they were really quite stark. So industrial production was down in the first 2 months by 13.5% year over year, far surpassing the consensus forecast of just 3% down year over year. Retail sales fell by over 20% year over year. That's the first decline on record. Investment dropped 24.5% year over year compared to the consensus forecast of -2%. And finally, the unemployment rate spiked to 6.2% from 5.2%. So by some indicators, some people have tried to translate those monthly indicators into sort of how that tracking relative to the quarterly GDP growth rate. And a number of estimates I've seen are about -10% annualized Q1 growth rate or contraction rate. So it was quite a negative performance. It's, in a way, I think it's reasonable when you think about, you know, how draconian the steps are in terms of whole cities and regions being quarantined. I think it's informative because it does sort of point, you know, as Europe and North America start thinking about these issues, we're going to face sort of a sharp negative economic downturn. The question is, how long does it last? And to me, that's the big question. And if we can get over this by fall, then I think, you know, the downturn can be minimized and we can revert to trend fairly quickly. If this lasts, if we're still dealing with the coronavirus in 12 months, then, you know, obviously then we're going to face a more prolonged economic downturn as we try to, you know, deal with the outbreak. But certainly China's experience was informative.
Can I make a comment, Dan, on that? Just
take it away. Interest.
Yeah, I thought this is interesting. Again, we're all trying to, you know, handicap what this where the peak and the trough are for these things and you know figure, you know, how that might apply to what we're experiencing right now in North America and European markets. But I just thought it was interesting that the markets, I think, are off like what 25 to 30% from their highs in February. Since that time, interestingly, I think China, where the spread of COVID sort of, as we know, has kind of slowed, the Shanghai Stock Exchange is down less than 3% over that same period of time. So again, thinking about markets as discounting mechanisms, even though you're seeing these, you know, as Todd pointed out, terrible, terrible economic data coming out, the markets, you know, obviously have discounted a lot of that going into these into the release of this data. So I don't know. Again, you don't know how these things are going to track in North America and Europe, but it's interesting that in the face of this terrible data, the Chinese stock market's actually, you know, relatively benign.
I think that's a great point, Darren. You know, what's so important here is, and this is where the longer horizon is important, is, We don't know exactly when the bounce will come, but, you know, when in China we started to see declining number of additional cases, the market got a sense that the outbreak was under control, was stabilizing. We started to see a very strong snapback in the local markets. And of course, China's overperforming relative to, you know, the rest of the world right now, where we're still, like, we're sort of dealing with where China was, you know, over a month ago. So, you know, it is actually some silver lining or a little bit of optimism from a market perspective that, you know, once we get our hands around this problem with the coronavirus, that, we could see, you know, a snapback in financial markets.
Thanks for that. Justina, do we have questions from our advisors on the line?
Thank you. Yes, we do. First question is from Peter McIntosh. Please go ahead.
Thank you, gentlemen. My question maybe is directed to Todd. Todd, what's helpful for us as we talk to our clients is to give them some understanding of what triggers trading. For example, we know the institutional trading is 80-85% of the market. How much do margin calls trigger trading in a crisis like this?
Thanks for the question, and I think it's an interesting question. So there's definitely a, you know, I think if I can get to your question, I think what you're asking in a way is how much is sort of forced liquidations might be playing a role in the sense of margin calls forcing people to sell assets, perhaps because of losses in other parts of their portfolio.
Correct.
So I think that's definitely an issue, particularly, you know, this is one of the indications of, you know, when you start to see market stress, you know, there's a number of indicators of that. I mean, just elevated volatility is certainly something that can cause losses for a subset of investors. It could be through margin calls, or even if they're not levered, they may be forced to liquidate other assets just to rebalance. In other places where I, you know, thinking about institutional strategic asset allocation, where I played a role in the past, one of the biggest concerns was exactly what you're asking, which is when you have a lot of leverage in your portfolio, and we see these kind of volatile movements, does it, in order to maintain a similar level of risk, do you have to do a lot of trading to reduce sort of the trade sizes, the position sizes, to kind of get your risk back under control? And there's definitely a subset of investors who do have that kind of strategy. It's difficult to put numbers on it or a percentage of the market, but it's not always clear because some people are both long and short. So, you know, the margin, you know, where they might be losing on one end of the trade, they're gaining on the other. So, you know, so that on a net basis, they're not sort of forced to sell stocks on that basis. I think it's very important. And I think the things we look for, as I mentioned, jumps in the VIX, like those kinds of risk indicators. And we also look for unusual things happening in cross asset correlations. A great example of that was last week when we, within the trading sessions, we saw treasury yields rising while the stock market was falling.
Mm-hmm.
And normally you tend to expect the exact opposite. You would expect in a very strong risk off scenario, you would expect to see yields falling, of course, and the flight to safety as the stock market is selling off. So when you see those kinds of odd cross asset class correlations, it does point to perhaps the things that you're talking about.
Thanks.
Thank you. And the next question is from Mark. Please state your full name and go ahead.
Oh, hi. My name is Mark, and I'm just asking for people who play this way more defensively than, you know, being in a bounce style portfolio just because it was coming, or maybe they got a windfall of cash from other means. And you're sitting at this point watching, you know, at almost 30% lows and kind of explaining these market turbulent times. My question is, how would you strategically come into this market to take advantage of what I'll call a replicated 2008 in sense of like downfalls and uncertainty to get that bounce back? And what sectors would you be focusing on, i.e. oil, i.e. technology, i.e. global, i.e. whatever you would take in those terms.
So, do you want to get a stat, and I'll give you my 2 cents worth?
Sure, I'll take a first crack at it. So, I think your question is, if you have a conservative investor who's seen some losses with the recent sell-off, how can you advise them to position for sort of the rebound when that eventually comes, and how what would that positioning look like? So, I hope that summarizes your question.
It's more like actually like, if you're doing an actual investment loan or you actually have hard cash because of other means and now you really want to take advantage of the market, how would you do that? It doesn't matter if they're conservative or not. It's just that you've been able to play because you had actual hard asset of actual liquidity to deploy. How would you play that into this market over the next 6 months to a year? It's more about actually having the cash. And you might be a 100% advanced player in the market, but there's just other means you have that wasn't in the market.
Sort of. I think I get it. So if you have liquidity or cash from another source and you want to deploy it in the market, what's the best way to do that? Sort of with the view that the market could at some point probably, you know, gain pretty strongly once this sort of is over, once the coronavirus blows over.
Right.
I think for me, I look at our investment approach, at least on the multi-asset strategy team. We would look, especially for a tactical type of view like that, we would look at three factors. The first are valuations. The second is macroeconomic conditions. And the third is what we call investor sentiment. Clearly, valuations are improved considerably with the big sell-off. The problem is valuation is terrible for timing, especially tactical timing like you're describing. So then the other two factors are what we use to try to time entry into an undervalued position like that. So macroeconomic conditions are still deteriorating. So that would be bearish for example, if you wanted to get long stocks. Same with sentiment. If you think of investor sentiment, it's extremely negative at the moment around equities. So overall, this would not be a good time within our investment process to get overweight in stocks. So, you know, when those things start to align, so let's say you see improving market technicals, the valuations, of course, are more attractive after the sell-off. And if we start to see the macro outlook improving, then I think that sets the stage for a pretty bullish equity view. Maybe I'll turn it over to Darren.
Todd. I would say I'm gonna completely not disagree with Todd, but I will say that if this gentleman or your client, if it's you or your clients, have 100% cash right now, I would put some percentage. I would not wait. I would put some percentage of that cash, whether it's 10 or 15 or 20%, in the market right now. And now, I wouldn't put it all in. I think I want to be, again, respectful of the fact that this individual is conservative and has worried about capital losses.
There's no conservativity here.
Okay. Sorry,
there's no conservativity. Like, this is 100% like we've been waiting and now it's time to go.
This is,
you know what I mean?
Then I would be putting money into the market tomorrow. And I'll tell you, now, 100%, no, okay, if you've got, but start putting it in tomorrow. And, if you asked about sectors or areas, now, I'll tell you, over the last 2 weeks, the companies that we bought include media and entertainment businesses. We have financial service companies, both in developed markets and in emerging market. I have an ingredients company. I have a testing and measurement business. I have a design software business. They are all over the place. High-end business services. There's a huge range of companies that we've been buying. There's no one particular area that we're focusing on. But I will say where we have not been investing and where, again, this comes down to high-grading the portfolio, we have not been investing in energy. We think there are higher quality ways. Now, I'm not saying, it's almost impossible to avoid, call it the energy space, because whether you're an aerospace company or you're an industrial business, you're going to have some exposure to energy or the oil patch. But we have not been investing in direct sort of call it extractors or extracting industries during this time period.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Sorry, Todd, I didn't mean to disagree with you there.
No, it takes two for a market, right?
That's right.
Well said.
Thank you. And the next question is from Kim Seid. Please go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. I just had a question on the recent liquidity options that the Fed's put forward for the Canadian financial institutions. And I was under the impression that with that, that they put forward that we would see rates dropping for mortgages. However, I've seen the opposite potentially starting to happen starting tomorrow. I wondered what your thoughts were on that and why you think they may be doing that.
Should I take a first crack at that?
Yeah, Todd, that's above my pay grade, I think.
That's a tough one to answer. it's a great question. I think you're asking, you know, given that we've seen a drop in the Bank of Canada's policy rates, we've seen liquidity operations by the central bank, why aren't we seeing variable rate mortgages drop? I think, is that summarized your question?
Actually, we're just in the middle of a mortgage renewal ourselves. So we locked in a rate yesterday and then got notice that the rates are likely to go up in the next day or so. And so it's a combination of an open and a closed. And on the closed, the rate's going up. On the open, the rate's going down. So I was just curious to know where the institution's thought process is on that and whether or not there might be some further direction from the government that they aren't to stockpile on that front, as opposed to be having the opposite objective, which is to allow for liquidity to flow for Canadians to be able to spend in these tight times.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. On the variable part, I guess I'm not surprised that the rate is falling. Those are tied, let's say, to the prime rate, and there should be downward pressure on the prime rate. I mean, Canada has a bit of a monopolistic banking system. So, you know, sometimes the prime rate doesn't drop sort of in line with or proportionally with the drop in the Bank of Canada's policy rates. As a variable rate holder myself, I've been waiting patiently for that. I think we will see more and more pressure on that. You're exactly right. The government is trying to stimulate consumer spending and create more disposable income for Canadians by lowering interest rates and by taking fiscal measures. The banking regulator has also eased some of the constraints, some of the regulations operating on the banks, to try to help ease providing credit to households and businesses. So I think there will be, my guess would be that the regulator and the Canadian government will start putting more pressure on the banking system to start letting this flow through. One of the reasons they may be reluctant is because with rates hitting rock bottom, interest margins are declining. And this is one of the problems with low interest rates that we've seen in Europe and Japan, is when rates start to hit these bounds, at some point, you know, they become negative in terms of bank health, and then banks are less likely or less motivated to provide credit, at such low interest rates. I'm not sure we're there in Canada, but it is one possibility, and I'm sure central banks and others would be thinking about those issues. But to your question, I do feel like this is a regulator type issue, and they're likely to go there. On the rising close rate, that's interesting. I'm afraid I don't have a good insight for you on that one, but I'm kind of intrigued by that, so I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, I had the same question, and I did pose it back to the financial institution to get clarification on that. However, they didn't have an answer for me either, so I was curious to know whether or not we're missing a piece of this link, just from an insider perspective. So.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I can't help you with the second part of the question.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks for trying, Todd. How about Justina? Do we have another question on the line?
Yes, we do. It's from Wiley Hughes. Please go ahead.
Hey, so this is actually more of a question for Darren, but Todd, if you have any input, be sure to throw it in there.
Sure.
In terms of company valuations, did we have a recession price into our intrinsic value calculations before the volatility happened?
Yeah, I think, you know, with every one of our companies, I would say we assume a wide range of scenarios. Like, we put a probability on, okay, what happens if, you know, with every one of our companies, if we do hit a recession. Obviously, a month ago, that probability was lower than it was, than it is today. And so you have to think, when we're thinking about our intrinsics, we're assuming that a wide range of scenarios, and we're adjusting those scenarios sort of in, like, on an ongoing basis. This happens so quickly, and, you know, every one of our companies, we assume that, what does this mean in a recession? This happened in a matter of, it seems like, probably 2 weeks. And, you know, obviously there's companies that are now priced in. We have certain assumptions that, put it this way, the companies that we believe are going to be facing tough times in a recession, okay, we have made changes. And this is part of the process. And so 2 weeks ago, when things started to become a little bit more, let's call it abnormal, or when we started to see that the impact of this stuff was going to be more significant than what we had assumed, we went to every one of our companies and we looked at our portfolio and said, I talked to the team about this. I still remember this. I said, look, if there are businesses that we own that we're not comfortable buying that could be down 20, 25, 30%, then we're selling them tomorrow. And that's when we actually made a lot of changes, the week of February 21st, 24th. And so there are businesses like, I mean, I can't tell you specifically, but there are companies that we own in industries that we completely liquidated 2 weeks ago because in a recession scenario, these prices and intrinsics, in fact, will be coming down more than what we anticipated. So, to answer your question, we have that assumption with every time we buy a company, whether it's, you know, 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago. We changed our assumptions fairly quickly, and we made some fairly quick adjustments to the portfolio 2 weeks ago. Again, we're in the process of selling turning over 23% of the companies of the fund. And, this happened fairly quickly and, you know, we made some mistakes, obviously, but we have also, I think, by and large, we're happy with the decisions we made starting 2 weeks ago, because to answer your question, we did start thinking about that and, adding that probability started creeping up fairly quickly, and as quick as I've seen, starting 2 weeks ago.
Yes. So by the end of February, you guys are pretty comfortable with where your assumptions have laid before the bulk of the volatility came through.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, again, we looked at if there were any balance sheet issues or the companies that we weren't comfortable buying at significant lower prices, they were gone.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Anything to add, Todd?
No, I think in terms of company fair valuation and that kind of thing, I think that's Darren's territory for sure. I would just say that in January, before the volatility hit, one of the things we did on our team in multi-asset strategies was to look at the contribution to portfolio risk from different asset classes, and to see, you know, and at that time we started adding government bond duration risk, because we didn't want, after the sort of the huge rally in equities we had for so long, equities were becoming too large of a risk exposure on a total portfolio basis. So we kind of looked at it on a risk management basis.
I would also add too,
we adjusted our hedges as well. We took our hedges, our euro, our Canadian hedges down, and both our EU and our Swiss franc and our pound sterling hedges down somewhat as well. So we had more of an open, we reduced our hedges back in the Canadian dollar.
Perfect. Thank you, gentlemen. Justina, do we have one more question on the line?
Yes, we do. And the next question is from John Klotz. Please go ahead.
Hi. Firstly, a very scary situation out there for all our clients. I'm more on the health, obviously, and I'm glad you guys are addressing that. But my questions are, watching, you know, various presidential speeches, you know, Trump is saying basically the underlyings of the economy are very good And if this coronavirus does is dealt with, which is, if and when there's going to, the fundamentals are there. I wanted, if you could address your thoughts to that. And also, I was talking to an advisor who is looking at investing in at China at this point. I just want to know your thoughts on all that.
Okay. Should I kick that off?
Sure. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Great. So, second question was on investing in China. Your first question was?
Well, basically, Trump has been saying the underlying economy is very good. That obviously the coronavirus has thrown the wrench.
Right.
And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, I think we're definitely in store for one very challenging quarter in the U.S. economy at the very least. And I think, like we were talking about with China, I mean, there's no way to know whether we'll see something that negative. But I think we're going to definitely see a rough quarter. Now, will we see sort of two rough quarters or even more, turning this into a recession? The risk has certainly gone up. But it's so unprecedented, the nature of this, coronavirus outbreak, that it really depends on how the cases will unfold. So, for President Trump to say that, things are very strong, I think one thing that is true is that there's an enormous amount of stimulus in the system now. So we have all of the central bank stimulus globally. We have an enormous fiscal stimulus package currently being discussed with Congress that's likely to go through in due course. Once we do finally get the coronavirus under control, let's even call it two quarters, we have a huge tailwind of enormous monetary and fiscal policy stimulus to give the economy a lift once things start to normalize. And I think that's one silver lining here. And, it's also worth remembering that some of that stimulus, actually much of the stimulus, actually started as early as mid-2019 when global central banks were cutting rates at a very rapid rate. And that's what, in part, fueled the huge equity rally that started back in October. So, those macro forces, once they're able to work their way through the economy, when the coronavirus kind of confidence shock is over, I think we could see a very strong rebound later this year, beginning of 2021. The timeline's a bit uncertain just because of the nature of the shock. In terms of China, I think that was your second question. On China, I think investing in China is, it's a great diversifier in a portfolio. I think even those of us that were passive investors are going to get more and more exposure to Chinese equities just by the fact that they're becoming a bigger part of the global stock market capitalization, in sort of standard indexes. So I think getting exposure to China, it's kind of an inevitable thing for most of us who have globally diversified portfolios.
Okay. Maybe I'll step in there too. I would say, and I'm not going to make a comment on I think Todd said everything with respect to what's in the hopper right now once we get through this COVID-19 situation from a fiscal and monetary standpoint. I would point out what nobody's really talking about, what certainly isn't being discussed in the market. And again, I mean, we all read the same things. There's a lot of different we invest and look at companies that invest in this area. What nobody's discounting is, forget about a vaccine. Okay. Even if something was to, come through that was viable tomorrow, it's going to take several months at least to work its way through the FDA and the proper scientific processes in terms of testing and certainly human trials. Yeah. But what nobody is discounting is that there's treatment that could come available, not a cure, but a treatment. And that, there's a number of things that I read that sound reasonable. Again, I'm not an epidemiologist or a doctor, but this is what, again, you think about what Todd said about the massive amount of stimulus that's going on. The fact that we're dealing with enormous uncertainty. We've never dealt with this. Okay? None of us were alive in 1919, right? Dealing, and none of us were operating in the stock market then either. when the Spanish flu came through. And so this is what is contributing to such the unease and the volatility. But it doesn't, as you can tell, like look at the ways the market's traded the last several days. This thing can turn on a dime. It can go a lot lower before then, of course, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's not being discounted in the market. And at some point in time, again, we don't know when this will start to become real. In terms of China, I have not added any A shares, as of yet, but I have added to significantly, three of our Chinese exposed holdings that trade in Asia, but I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you.
Todd and Darren, thank you very much for your support as always. And for each of you on the phone, these calls have been organized as a series and they're extending into early May. So they're each week, each Tuesday at 4:00 Eastern. And we offer these calls because we know it's important for you to hear from our portfolio managers. And we truly do hope that you're finding value in the time that you're spending with us. Next week, we're hosting Paul Taylor, a portfolio manager of our Mackenzie Multi-Asset Strategies team, as well as Phil Toller, portfolio manager and lead on our Mackenzie Growth team. I'm going to leave it at that. I'll leave you with this. We wish you all the best. Stay confident, stay healthy, and thank you all very much for joining today. Have a wonderful afternoon.